Succession number 19392, Reel 4.
Donald Evans, Reel 4.
This box, you tore this box up into little bits, and the idea was you boiled the water to make your, as I say, your coffee or your bouillon, which is, I suppose, French for soup. And we, at one of the stations, we bought bananas and we made a sort of barbecue thing using the bananas and using a mess tin on the top to boil the water. And of course, not only did we have coffee or whatever it was and the grub that was in these K-rations, but we had a byproduct of roast bananas, which was quite acceptable. Bit hazy then, but ultimately we shipped again for Malaya. And that was in December 45. As I expect everyone knows, the idea was that after the capture of Rangoon and before the Japanese surrender on the 15th of August, which actually wasn't implemented till September, there was going to be an assault on Malaya with landings at Port Dickson and Port Swettenham and other places, no doubt. It was known as Operation Zipper. And it was called that because, so it was said, because nothing was buttoned up, which is rather a sort of army takeoff of these rather pretentious names. Anyway, be that as it may, the landings took place unopposed, and we landed in Singapore. If it was the whole division or not, I'm not sure. Certainly it was 6th Brigade. Landed in Singapore on the 31st of December 1945. I remember it well because we had a whale of a New Year's party. Talking of parties, I should have said when we were in Rangoon, if I may just go back a few months, when we were in Rangoon in August, the word came through that a bomb had been dropped in Japan, on Japan, which didn't impress us very much, and then another one. And we didn't realise that it was a bomb of a different, it wasn't just different in degree, it was different in kind. That was the atomic bombs. And when the news came through that the Japanese were contemplating surrender, we just did not believe it. It just was not credible, because individually and collectively, our experience was that the Japanese did not surrender. The number of prisoners taken, I don't know how many it was, but certainly it was very, very few. I think it was sort of in tens, unwounded prisoners, in tens in the whole campaign. They were a people that fought to the death. And the idea that they surrendered, we were all geared up to a long campaign through the Dutch East Indies and French Indochina and so forth. So we couldn't believe it. Anyway, it was confirmed, and the word went round there was going to be a great party in Government House, and everyone went down there. And I remember we got 8 officers in one jeep, which is overloading it somewhat. We all went down, took our own booze, and had a whale of a party in the governor's house. The funny thing was that in insane jail, that is INSEIN, not insane in the other sense, there was a Indian cavalry regiment. I don't know what tanks they had, but they had gone down the Prome Road towards the governor's house, and they had one of their guns traversed at 90 degrees, or whatever, as near as 90 degrees it would get, and unfortunately it seemed to knock off a good many of the telegraph poles on the Prome Road, presumably before they realised what was happening. Because when we got to the government house, there were military police swarming over this tank, you know, taking its number and all the rest of it, because of the damage it had done on the way down. Why they should have got, considering the general damage and throughout the whole of the country, why they should be fussed about a few telegraph poles, I don't know, but I suppose they were being thoroughly officious. And this was no end of a party at Government House. The governor wasn't there, of course, which is probably just as well. But there it was, and as I said, in Singapore we had another enormous party on New Year's Day, 1946 it would be, and we went up, I had Japanese prisoners of war working for me on stores. I'd moved then to from the 506 Field Company to 219 Field Park Company, which was quite fun. It had bulldozers and so forth, which of course the field companies didn't have. They called it up from the field park. And as the war was then over, it was rather fun having all sorts of mechanical equipment, graders and bulldozers and things to play with. And we had Japanese prisoners of war.
How did you find them to handle?
I had no problem handling them. You dealt with their officers, and their officers dealt with them. They had a much stricter code of discipline than we had. A chap, something wrong, he had his face smacked in where he stood. But that was the way they did it. It wasn't the way we did it, but it was up to them. And then, in due course, repatriated to UK and demobbed.
What was the attitude of you and your brother officers towards the Japanese in the Burma campaign?
In the campaign or afterwards?
Both.
Well, in the campaign, I think everyone regarded them as intensely dedicated. There was no doubt about it, there was a propaganda move, justified or not, showing them as inhuman. Now, since the war, I've learned that though there were atrocities, and indeed atrocities on both sides, it must be said, which are certainly cannot be condoned in any sense, their attitudes were inculcated by the social milieu in which they were brought up. Absolute obedience to the emperor, that death is something incidental. If it happens, they end up in the Asakuni shrine with their honour intact. They've got a very highly developed sense of honour, and some of the POWs who were ill-treated would doubtless challenge this, but I think it's absolutely true, and I've since read the Imperial Rescript on to soldiers and sailors of the Japanese forces, and the sentiments are unexceptionable, in fact quite laudable. Having said that, I think they were enormously respected as soldiers. They had a tenacity and, how should I say, willingness for self-sacrifice that few of our people could match. Now you may say, well, look at the Royal West Kents at Kohima. Could anyone have shown more tenacity than that? And the answer is no, they couldn't. But the Japanese did it in almost all situations. On the other hand, one felt there was a disparity between some of their commanders at sort of colonel level, regimental commanders, who showed initiative and drive and imagination, whereas perhaps some of their lower formation, like company commanders or platoon commanders, tended to repeat the same mistakes. In other words, they tried once, it wouldn't work. They tried again, it still didn't work. So you might say that showed tenacity, but not judgment. Whereas some of their higher formation, higher commanders, did. I mean, I can't now recall the names of them, but Colonel Tanahashi in the Arakan was an example of that. Not that I had any knowledge of him, or except subsequently by reading, but it's quite clear they showed initiative and imagination. Certainly one had, there was never any compunction about trying to kill them, because they would have tried to kill us. So,
did you see any atrocities or the aftermath?
No. I saw plenty of dead, but no atrocities as such. You see, I'm not sure, you talk of atrocities, I'm not sure that the atrocities were committed except on apart from the POWs, which is a separate issue, and it's one which I think propaganda has distorted the position on POWs. But as far, I mean, I know that there were atrocities. I haven't actually personally seen them. I know that people were tied to trees and bayonets as practice and so forth. I know that various atrocities were perpetrated. On the other hand, but I never saw any. On the other hand, I believe that atrocities were perpetrated by our own people, in that we shot prisoners who had surrendered or been captured. Which in many, quite apart from the moral considerations, was stupid, because you might have got information from them under interrogation. Now, I know that's been done, though again I never saw it. And I believe that quite a lot of wounded were dispatched, were killed. That raises a very interesting moral situation, because if you can't deal with your own wounded, should you accord the wounded of the enemy greater care? The answer, I think, must be no. You try and get and if you can't deal with your own people, why should you deal with the enemy? But that's a very difficult question, which I wouldn't want to pursue.
How do you feel now about having served in the Royal Engineers in the Second World War?
Well, it's part of life. An interesting part of life. I'm glad I did. Have no hesitation in saying I'm glad I did. You see, parts of it, and this is often forgotten, parts of it were not desperately pleasant, and certainly highly dangerous, and one wouldn't wish to sort of take part. But there are parts of it where it was a bit like a sort of Boy Scout jamboree. You know, if you were away from things and you had very little control. I mean, there weren't accountants looking over you and saying, well, why did you use 48 gallons of petrol last month instead of something else, you know, that sort of thing. And there was stuff there. You You were completely free. There was no peacetime accounting. I mean, you throw something away when it's no use. You don't have to account for it. I remember I wrecked a Jeep. And the 2IC, who was a very nice chap, said, "There you are, you'll have to pay for that Jeep, you know." So I said, "You know, this is absolute balls. It might well have been. Indeed, we lost it over the countryside, but it might have been blown up. It might have been set fire to, and so forth. You see, you can forget that one." And of course, he just laughed it off. But he was only teasing. But there was none of that constraint, you see.
Did you have any long-term effects from living and working and fighting in Burma?
I think the only long-term effect I had was a sort of increased tolerance factor.
But not on your health?
Not on my health at all, to my knowledge. I mean, such mental deterioration as I have is a function of age, not of experience.